on time today. My name's Ed Howard. I'm with the Alliance for Health Reform, and on behalf of Senator Rockefeller, Senator Collins, our board of directors, I want to welcome you to this briefing on the way we pay for health care and how changing the way we pay for health care fits or doesn't fit with the move to reform the health care system in general. Now, there are a lot of exceptions you're going to hear about some of them today, but most health care in the United States is still paid for through a fee-for-service method. Each individual service, a procedure, a test, a physician visit is reimbursed, if you're lucky, right? Now, the analysts and policymakers with a whole lot of different viewpoints on how to reform the system seem to be coming to a rough consensus that reforming the payment system is an essential ingredient in getting better value for our healthcare dollar, in getting a handle on cost growth in general, in improving the outcomes of healthcare interventions. And there's somewhat less than unanimous agreement on how the payment system should be changed to reach those goals, and today's briefing is designed to explore some of those proposed changes. Our partner and co-sponsor in this briefing, the Commonwealth Fund, has commissioned or actually carried out some of the most thoughtful and useful analyses of the reform implications of payment policy change. I also want to say a special word of thanks to Susan Dentzer and her colleagues at Health Affairs, a leading policy journal in the United States, for making available this Value in Healthcare volume, which collects a number of thoughtful papers, including one by one of our lead-off speakers here, that is based on discussion at last spring's Princeton conference. Now, at this point, I'd like to call on the Commonwealth Fund's Karen Davis, who is in her own right one of the country's leading healthcare analysts and who will be co-moderating today's briefing. Karen?
Thanks, Ed. Thanks for hosting this seminar, and thanks for inviting a terrific audience today. It's great to see the room packed, but that also means that there's a lot of work done by the Alliance for Health Reform staff in pulling this event off, so many thanks to you and your able staff for that. I might just make a few general comments to reinforce those that Ed has made, and the first is to think about payment reform in the context of health reform, whose goals include improving access to care, improving the quality of care, and slowing the growth in healthcare costs. Now, that may seem obvious, but too often when we come at the issue of payment in this town, we're really talking about the federal budget and how to achieve savings or close the gap in budget deficit through Medicare payment reform, but I think it's important to think about payment reform in the broader context of the objectives of how that can be a tool for changing the delivery of healthcare services, improving quality, improving access to care, and as well as addressing the economic concerns about the rapid rise in healthcare costs. And I think the other mind shift is to think about payment reform not as just affecting the price of a given service. Again, we get great recommendations from the Medicare Payment Assessment Commission about updates, so many times we get focused on updates. But I really think when we talk about payment reform, we need to be thinking about how incentives can leverage change in the way healthcare is organized and delivered for the benefit of patients to have better access to care and improve quality. The third point I'd like to make is I think it's really important to have a comprehensive approach that thinks simultaneously about access, quality, and cost and doesn't just work on the issue of cost. Again, in any budget cycle, in any economic situation, there's a tendency to focus exclusively on cost. But the real difficulty with thinking about that, slowing the growth in cost without addressing the access problem, is you run the risk of squeezing those who are least able to pay out of the healthcare system. obviously, if you're under economic pressure as a provider organization, cutting back on uncompensated care, care to those who can't pay, is one strategy that you may be forced to pursue, as they say, no margin, no mission. So even those that are very committed to serving the uninsured and those who can't pay find it tough in any era of provider payment change. So it's important to think about this in terms of also covering the uninsured and making sure that care is affordable for people. And then the final point I would make is how important it is to think about not just those age 65 and over covered by Medicare, but how do we change incentives for those in the working population as well? Again, trying to do things just in Medicare will not have the impact on the healthcare system that trying to do something more broadly. Obviously, Medicare can be an innovator. Medicare can lead. But in the end, Medicare can't do it alone, and it's important to think about reform in the broader context of the way in which providers are paid across all forms of insurance coverage. So with that, I'll turn it back to Ed.
Great. Thank you, Karen. Just a couple of logistical items. You have in your packets a lot of background information, including biographical info on all of our speakers to supplement the very modest introductions they're going to get here. Tomorrow you'll be able to, that is to say Monday, you'll be able to view a webcast of this briefing on kaisernetwork.org, for which we're very grateful. And in a few days you'll be able to see a transcript both on the kaisernetwork.org website and on the Alliance website. You can even download a podcast if you know how to do that. At the appropriate time, you'll find green cards in your packets to use to write a question on. There are also some microphones, one here and one in the middle of the room, that you can use to talk your question through, and a blue evaluation form that I hope you'll take the time to fill out before you leave. Enough. We have, as Karen noted, a terrific lineup of people, both expert with Medicare and expert in the healthcare system in general, and we're going to start off with Stu Gutterman. Excuse me. Stu's an assistant vice president of Commonwealth for their program on Medicare's future. He's done stints at MedPAC and CBO. And before he joined Commonwealth, he was director of the Office of Research and Demonstrations at the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services, in effect overseeing a range of studies and demonstrations involving Medicare's payment methods. He's going to kick off today's discussion by outlining for us the payment recommendations contained in the report Path to a High-Performance U.S. Health System that was recently issued by Commonwealth's Commission on a High-Performance Health System. Stu, thanks for being with us.
Thanks, Ed. As Ed mentioned, I'm going to talk about the payment reform policies that were recommended in the Commission's report. I'll start out first by giving you an overview of the context of those payment reform recommendations. The Commission set out to address the fixing the three-legged stool of healthcare to address problems with access, quality, and cost of care. And as Karen mentioned, those three aspects of the healthcare system are A, all broken in the current system, and B, all need to be fixed together to be able to be most effective. The Commission developed five strategies, and under those strategies, they've recommended several changes in the healthcare system to improve access, to provide affordable coverage for all, to align incentives better in the healthcare system, to improve quality and health outcomes, and to provide better, more patient-centered care. And they also call for leadership and collaboration to achieve this because everybody's got a stake in this and everybody's got things that they're potentially wary about changing, and so everybody's going to need to chip in and contribute to this process. We modeled a set of policies to recommend to represent the Commission's recommendations, and I want to summarize quickly some of the impacts that we modeled. On the access issue, I think the best representation of what would happen under the Commission's recommendations is that you would get to from a point where currently we have about 48 million people uninsured, projected to go up to about 61 million, and these projections were made before the latest rounds of economic problems we have, to down to about 4 million people. That is basically coverage for everybody in the United States, but the modeling assumed that there were some people that just weren't going to be able to be reached from the system. But we think that over time, because every time you had contact with the healthcare system, you would be enrolled. There would be even a greater impact on coverage for healthcare. In terms of healthcare outcomes, this chart summarizes the changes if we could achieve what we have identified as reachable benchmarks for preventive care, on reducing unnecessary admissions and readmissions to hospitals, and so on. These are things that represent a massive potential for our healthcare system to increase its value to the population of this country. And the impact on cost is represented in this chart. We are currently at $2.6 trillion in 2009. By the end of the next decade, we're projected to increase to $5.2 trillion in healthcare spending. The total impact of the Commission's recommendations would be to, by 2020, reduce that amount to $4.6 trillion, still a massive amount of money. But it represents that wedge between the top two curves in this graph represents a total cumulative reduction in health spending over this period of $3 trillion that can be used elsewhere in the economy, in the healthcare sector, to cover some of the expenses incurred in achieving these improvements. So focusing on the payment reform, this chart has been in several fund and commission publications. It represents the interrelation between organization and payment. The main message to draw from this is that we need to move from the fee-for-service system that dominates our health care now to payment systems that reward taking broader accountability for patient outcomes and care, and also for high performance in terms of efficiency as well. And to recognize the fact that we have an array of different organizations in the healthcare delivery system, and we could apply more bundled payment to each of the steps in that array of healthcare. The main point to take away from these payment reforms is that the purpose of these payment reforms is not to reduce payments. It is to encourage a reorganization of the healthcare system so that costs increase more slowly, as well as quality increasing for the patients that the system serves. When we model the set of representative policies, you end up with between 2010 and 2020, an 11-year period, an estimated saving reduction in national health expenditures of over $1 trillion from these payment reforms. And the payment reforms include enhanced payment for primary care, that is higher updates for primary care services, payments to encourage adoption of the medical home model, which offers better coordination of care for their patients, and bundled payment for acute care episodes is what we modeled. That is to extend the payment bundle that's paid for from the hospital stay and hospital services, which is currently embodied in the DRG system that Medicare pays according to a broader set of services, eventually including both the hospital stay and 30 days post-discharge from the hospital, and also post-acute care and also physician services in the hospital, to really encourage providers to work together to manage both the costs and the care that their patients receive. We also had several policies that we modeled that we called correcting price signals, which would adjust payment updates for providers in high-cost areas relative to the national median. We would also implement a couple of policies that were suggested by some work that was done for the Hamilton Group on prescription drug pricing, and we would eliminate the overpayment of Medicare Advantage plans in the Medicare program. These are policies that are assumed to apply to Medicare, Medicaid, a new public health insurance plan that would be available through a health insurance exchange that's part of the coverage set of recommendations, and would assumed eventually to be adopted, or at least policies that achieve the same kinds of ends being adopted in the private sector as well. Now, why do we need to do these things? Well, this is one of several graphs that have by now become famous, representing the Dartmouth Atlas analyses of variation in both quality and cost. This is a pretty graphic, literally graphic, representation of how wide the variation is in cost across areas in this country, and without any corresponding effect, apparently, on quality. And you can measure quality, you can measure outcomes quality by any of a number of measures, and you get the same kind of relationship. And a very nice table that was produced in an article by Glenn Hackbarth, who's a member of the commission and also the chair of the Medicare Payment Advisory Commission, lays out pretty clearly what drives variation in spending. They looked at the risk-adjusted standardized spending for chronic obstructive pulmonary disease and several other conditions, but in particular, these numbers show that really what drives, there's wide variation between the highest cost and lowest cost areas in terms of spending on this condition, but you see from the extreme right-hand column here that the bulk of the variation is in the number of readmissions in these areas and in the cost of post-acute care in these areas. So that really drives the recommendation to bundle care, because you really need to make the hospital more responsible, but also have the ability to be rewarded for taking responsibility for the patient once the patient leaves the hospital as well. And you need to have post-acute care facilities brought into this decision so there's more continuity of care for people who need care in different settings and from different providers. And then the final point, this chart shows the trend, both currently projected and under the Commission's recommendations as we modeled them, in payments for hospitals and for physicians. And you see here that while spending decreases relative to current projections, it does increase over time. We're not talking about shutting down the healthcare system. We're talking about reducing cumulative spending from $42 trillion, as currently projected, to $39 trillion over the next 11 years. If there are people who think that's not enough money to spend on healthcare for without trying to improve quality as well, then I'd like to hear the explanation of why that's true. We're talking about reducing spending on healthcare from a 6.7% annual growth rate to a 5.5% annual growth rate, compared with 4.7% for GDP as a whole. So again, we're talking about healthcare continuing to grow as a part of our nation's economy, just not quite as fast as it would have otherwise. And I'll wrap up there with acknowledgments to Karen and Kathy Shane, Steve Schoenbaum, and Chris Stramikas, who contributed to the paper and to the work that's gone into this. Thanks.
Okay. Thanks very much, Stu. Next, we have Dr. Robert Berenson, who's a senior fellow at the Urban Institute and one of the country's leading Medicare experts. Talents he drew on back in 98 through 2000 when he was in charge of Medicare payment policy, basically, among other things at CMS. He's a physician. He's an internist. He served on the White House staff. Today we've asked him to flag some of the concerns in the leading proposals and things we need to think about as we look to reforming healthcare payment. Bob, thanks very much for being here.
It's a pleasure to be here. And a couple years ago I was here and we were talking about pay for performance, and that's certainly a worthy topic and has a role in all of this, but I was sort of scratching my head and saying, why are we talking about how we're going to spend the 2% at the margin, either in rewards or penalties, and not how we're spending the 100%? And in a couple of years, this has all changed now. It's impossible almost to go anywhere in town without a meeting on payment reform. I applaud that, and I want to make the point that it's the right topic, but it's not necessarily easy. And so I'm going to be bringing up a couple of the practical issues, partly wearing my old hat as a CMS administrator, looking at sort of how this stuff might play out on the ground a little more. So that's what I want to do in my 10 minutes. Fee-for-service clearly has gotten a bad reputation, and I'd say my first sort of points up there is deservedly so. It promotes volume growth, self-referral opportunities. Economists argue about how much physician-induced demand occurs, but it certainly does. Fragmented care, each, let's say, physician can be providing terrific care. But there's and there is coordination, but it's only because of a professional duty to coordinate, not because the payment system in any way is rewarding that coordination. And a second problem that has occurred, I think inadvertently to some extent in Medicare and certainly occurs in private payments, is that prices are distorted in relationship to underlying costs, which in turn distorts, and I should have said provider behavior, not just physician behavior. In fact, I give credit to the Center for Studying Health System Change, of which I'm a consultant, for going out and identifying the numerous examples of where hospitals in particular, but also physicians, determine how they are, what they're going to emphasize in the services they provide by basically identifying winners and losers services. And so service line strategies that hospitals have adopted really to go after the lucrative services. And so when I'm talking about distortions, it's in relationship to underlying costs. There are winners and there are losers. And as I'm going to argue, that's not inevitable. Fee-for-service actually can be a useful part of a payment system. And, in fact, it can promote desired behavior if you can identify and define that behavior crisply. And so, for example, in organizations that pay what we used to call capitation, that's become a dirty word, in addition to the per member per month payment, because there was a perception that vaccinations were being underperformed, now there's often fee-for-service payments specifically for those vaccinations to assure that they happen. So fee-for-service can and should be part of any payment reform. In fact, there are some physicians who maybe should be paid fee-for-service. We can talk about that more. So here very quickly are the reasons to spend some effort improving physician fee schedules. The alternatives, while conceptually better, are not easy. Getting fee-for-service prices will help set the conditions needed for other payment reforms. I did an interview with an administrator of a multi-specialty group practice who basically said, your fee schedule from Washington is making it impossible for me to recruit cardiologists and dermatologists, and he listed some other specialties, because they're making so much in fee-for-service reimbursements that they don't want to participate in a multi-specialty group. So you need to get the fee-for-service prices better. And also, the fee-for-service prices often are the building blocks for how you construct the episode payment or the capitated payment. And indeed, there have been examples of success. The Deficit Reduction Act limits on imaging, even though radiologists may not have liked it, actually in the first year of its implementation, reduced prices, reduced the rate of volume growth, led to a 13% savings for the program. I think it was actually, even though it was done in the middle of the night and people weren't sure exactly what they were accomplishing, it actually worked, I would argue. Now, there are opportunities to improve the physician fee schedule. After 17 years, we're still too reliant on estimates of the components that go into these fees. It's time we actually had real measurements of time, et cetera, that go into these fees. We can adjust where there's rapid volume growth. We can identify those are probably winning services, or they may be, in which you can make some adjustments. And CMS could be doing what, in essence, the health center change was doing, which is going out and hearing from hospitals and physicians, in this case physicians, where are the distorted payments? Which are the services that seem to be winners? And finally, I know there's this terminology of value-based purchasing has come up. I actually think it makes sense and to adopt it in a broader sense. A value-based purchaser would be asking in the physician fee schedule, are we getting enough? What services are we getting too much of, and what are we not getting enough of for the population we are serving? And I would say if you ask that question, you would come to the conclusion that we're not getting enough geriatric services, we're not getting enough care coordination services. To the extent that prices matter in terms of what people do, why don't we modify prices somewhat to try to get a better mix of services for the population we're taking care of? Now, the next topic, and this is a complex one, and I've got about a minute and a half to do this, bundles, they exist already. We pay a case rate for a hospital as a bundle payment for the case. We now pay home health agencies a 60-day episode for the episode of care. We used to pay each individual visit that was made. So that's the concept of what these bundles, episodes, cases are. Just a point of clarification, it is important to distinguish between bundling payments of different providers, let's say hospitals, physicians, or hospitals and post-acute care facilities, and paying over time to a single provider, or perhaps to that bundled set of providers. The former attempts to align incentives, essentially to defragment care amongst different silos. The latter attempts to internalize to the provider the benefits of greater efficiency and decreased resource use. So when you pay a hospital a case rate, it now has a reason to be efficient, at least within that case. But bundles have some of the same problems as pure fee-for-service. It is important to distinguish between aligning incentives and providing identical incentives. So, for example, providers under bundled payments still have an incentive to generate reimbursable units of reimbursement. Right now, and I also will agree, you heard from Stuart, that rehospitalizations is a particularly opportune and ripe area for public policy to reduce rehospitalization rates. Hospitals now have a negative business case for putting in systems that actually reduce rehospitalization. They get paid for keeping beds full. So we should change how we pay hospitals. But the question is whether, if we just align the incentives of doctors and hospitals, whether we've accomplished anything, if in fact some of these readmissions or indeed initial admissions are inappropriate to begin with. So if you set up a bundled rate for a hospitalization with the doctors and the hospitals, but in many of those situations that hospitalization or that procedure is inappropriate, and we know a lot, there's a lot of literature on inappropriate services, you've now aligned their incentives to be efficient within the bundle, but you haven't actually done anything as to whether that service should have been provided in the first place. It works better when you've got a good handle on appropriateness. Let me go to the next one very, very quickly. There's no time to get into the details. but there are political and technical challenges to episodes. Who gets the money? In some places where there's alignment of interests, where physicians perhaps are employed by the hospital, you can give the hospital the money and they can distribute that with the docs. In other places, there are wars going on between hospitals and physicians for control over the local health delivery system, and it's hard to imagine the political environment where the docs, for example, would accept the fact that the hospital's going to take the money and distribute it. There's a lot of technical challenges that we could talk about if you're interested. Ultimately, where we should be going in the ideal world would be the population-based payment. It's generally called per member per month. I put down per PPPM because we're not necessarily talking about members. We're talking about people. But an organization that's being paid to take care of a population, and you're going to hear about Geisinger in a second, if we had lots of Geisingers around, what we do is we fundamentally change the incentive. Now a hospitalization, instead of a profit center, becomes a cost center. The organization is paid for that population, regardless of how much services are being used. You can address provider fragmentation depending on the level of the payment. If it's at a system level, you now theoretically have everybody working together. Conceptually, this approach, if you have large enough organizations, you don't necessarily need a health plan intermediary. You could probably be contracting directly with an integrated delivery system under this approach and not have to pass it through a Medicare Advantage plan with the costs associated with that intermediary. There are technical challenges here, in particular the challenge of making sure underservice is not provided and you can detect it. However, I think we've got some promising results from the CMS physician group practice demonstration and the possibility that instead of full risk bearing by these organizations, shared risk with the payer, in this case CMS, might become a viable model. And finally, two final slides. In the end, we need to consider doing hybrids of all of these approaches. Each have their strengths and weaknesses. So, for example, the medical home, and we're trying to figure out exactly what that is, but it really is to improve the primary care patient-centeredness activities that physicians need to be providing, as well as more care coordination for patients with chronic conditions. Theoretically, you could still pay fee-for-service visits, but because the care coordination services can't be crisply defined in a CPT fee-for-service context, it is frequent phone calls, it is conversations with social service workers, with other physicians. That doesn't lend itself to fee-for-service. Perhaps that becomes a per-person, per-month fee to the practice. And you can even put in some public reporting or pay-for-performance for how well that practice is doing. Pay-for-performance actually can be used with any of these other payment systems to try to protect against some of the untoward side effects you want to prevent. And then finally, to reemphasize the point about alignment is not necessarily the same as providing identical results, I like the concept of bundling the payment for the hospital and other parties to try to provide an incentive to decrease readmissions. But here's another way, if you can't quite get there, you make it less desirable for hospitals to have a readmission. And indeed, there's this urban legend around that hospitals under Medicare are not paid for a readmission within 31 days. I've seen it stated authoritatively by experts in the field that Medicare doesn't pay for a readmission. In fact, they do. In rare situations, the intermediaries may find a quality problem and deny payment. So my argument is, if an urban legend can cause behavior change, which it does, why not actually have pay the readmission at a variable cost rate? Well, maybe that's 50% of the DRG, so the hospitals have an interest. And if you can't get the physicians to be part of that bundle, this is an area where you can create a CPT fee-for-service code for the physician's role in the handoff from the hospital back into the community. I can define those services, so you theoretically have a doc being paid fee-for-service. You have the hospital now with an incentive to decrease readmissions, and then maybe even providing direct support. The QIOs and Medicare are working on this to directly support community caseworkers, social workers, disease management nurses to act as coaches, to actually participate, go to the patient, go to the discharge planning, go to the patient's home, and those programs reliably reduce readmissions 25% to 40%. So the point I'm making here is that you can mix and match. There are some barriers to just full implementation of people's sort of perfect notions of a new payment model, but we can make a lot of progress and need to. Thank you very much.
Well, now that Bob's told hospitals that they do get paid for readmissions, we'll have to evaluate the impact of that statement.
Thanks very much, Bob. I apologize again for having to leave, but I could not leave you in more capable hands than that of Dr. Karen Davis. Karen, thanks very much for doing this.
And as a member of the Geisinger Board of Directors, it's a particular pleasure to welcome to the panel Dr. Bruce Hammering. He is the Executive Vice President and System Chief Medical Officer Emeritus for Geisinger. He's in charge of their research institutes and medical education activity. For those of you not familiar with Geisinger, it's located in central Pennsylvania and is an integrated delivery system and one of the most respected in the U.S. And I think particularly what Dr. Hammery will bring to us is some real-world experience with advanced payment methods so that we'll move from concept and theory to reality. Bruce.
Thank you very much. Good afternoon. I'm going to show you four quick slides on Geisinger, make a couple of comments, and then go into a couple of experiments that we've tried. And since this is a 10-minute limit, which I'm going to try to adhere to, I'm not going to give you much detail on the experiments. I'll rather talk about the lessons learned. As Dr. Davis mentioned, Geisinger is an integrated health system formed in 1914 by a gift from a then 86-year-old woman who gave $1.5 million to form a hospital and in her deed of trust said this is to care for the working man and his family. So we have had a patient-centric, community-based orientation since that time. We are a very integrated system. We comprise a very large employed provider group of about 740 physicians, plus 400 advanced practice nurses, PAs, CRNAs, and others, and several hospitals and a set of insurance companies. The insurance companies in aggregate account for about 28% of the provider business. The provider business accounts for about half of the insurance company's members. And so we have had some very interesting ways to model the effect of changes that our provider group makes, which with its integrated electronic medical record, with the community-based physicians who do not have electronic health records as sort of a control group. As I mentioned, we provide population-based care to about 35 very rural counties in Pennsylvania. Roughly 25% to 30% of this population sees a Geisinger provider every year. We have been recognized over the last number of years for our integrated patient-centered care, our leadership in the use of healthcare information technology. We do have and have had for 13 years a state-of-the-art electronic health record with patient portals, referring physician portals, electronic images, and all that good stuff, which we'll talk about in a minute. As was mentioned, we participate in a PGP demo, and we have had a system of bundled payments for certain acute care inpatient operations now up for about 3 years as an arrangement with our own health plan. I will note, have been unable to sell that to other insurers, although those discussions go on. And we can talk about why that might be if you wish. And we have had an experiment up with Medical Home, which we call Patient Navigator now for 2.5 years, which has shown reproducibly now over roughly 30 primary care sites up, including two non-Geisinger sites, reductions of 20 to 25% in Medicare admissions to hospitals, and a reduction in cost of about 6%, sustainable and reproducible as it comes up. Some sites have actually seen reductions in Medicare admissions of as much as 50%. And the byline there is that if you are a small hospital and 80% of your admissions are Medicare and 50% of them go away, you have changes to make. And if those Medicare admissions are going away because they were not necessary or because the care can be provided on an ambulatory setting where the patient's eating better food at home and sleeping in their own bed, those changes need to be made. Geisinger Health Plan here, a lot of regional reach, a lot of non-Geisinger providers. So what's needed to get this done for healthcare reform? Well, underlying basis, several of the speakers have said, people have to have insurance. Now, insurance is not access. I think probably everybody in this room has healthcare insurance. Those of you that live in Washington have a Blue Cross plan. And when I talk to you and you call your doctor, you can't get in less than 6 weeks. My guys can see you in 24 hours for a primary care visit for any reason. That's access. But it requires specific leadership and specific organizational design to get there. Insurance does not get you there. Health information technology is needed as an enabler. Governance that allows money to be moved between doctors and hospitals or between insurers and hospitals and doctors in ways that make sense to improve the care of patients and families is needed. This will require some stark action and some of that. And this gets to the concept that others have mentioned of accountable care organizations that can take responsibility for delivering high quality care and improve value. And I would note here, with all respect to others, that I think the elimination of widget-based payments will be required. Now, as Dr. Berenson said, I mean, some of that may still be needed, but at the end of the day, if we simply incent people to do more, and our ability to specify the right thing changes over time. So I would just call to your attention yesterday's New England Journal, where something that doctors have been pushing, which is PSA tests for old guys like me, has shown to probably be not the right thing to do. So if you embed that in legislation and new data comes out, you know how hard it is to change the law. Electronic health record, necessary but not sufficient. Electronic health records have to be accompanied by serious efforts to redesign care in the primary care site and in the hospital. This is not training that doctors have. It is not once and done. It requires going back at it. Mentioned bundled electronic health records are the basis for chronic disease care and do provide the basis for feeding back in real time at the end of the week or at the end of the day or during the visit, the correct care for doctors. Okay, acute care, we call this proven care. It was started in a paper world before we computerized the hospital, so electronic records are not needed for this, although they're helpful. It involves a bundled payment, which includes the physicians and the hospitals. It requires the embedding of best practice evidence-based medicine for each step of the care. That includes whether the care is appropriate. We found in the instances that we've tried this that it reduces complications, even in places that start from very good quality by external metrics. So cardiac surgery for us is a premier program. was among the best in the state on the statewide data, still reduced complication rates 50%, reduced readmission rates 50%, cut costs. And this is a bundled payment with our health plan that includes all related complications for 90 days following surgery. So it incents following the best procedures and taking care of the patient. That value, however, has to be shared between the purchaser and the provider, because it does, you know, there are systems that you have to set up to do this, so it doesn't just all disappear, although the dollars could be reduced over time. Medical home, we call Patient Navigator. This is a cooperative effort between our health plan and our primary care people. The health plan provides the analytics to talk about high-risk patients, identify those. Our health plan has actually taken people out of their telephone care coordination center, embedded them in the primary care site, and those, ladies and gentlemen, are responsible for tracking the patient from the hospital, making sure their medications sync up, that they're not taking two of something, that they get their medication prescriptions filled, and if they can't, help get them filled, and then they get them in to see the doc within 5 days after the appointment, after they leave the hospital. We've also had to design better ways to take care of people in nursing homes and to really re-engineer those handoffs and follow-ups. So this is not, and I repeat, not simply a few extra dollars for the primary care doctor for them to learn skills that they have not learned and don't have time to do. This is putting additional staff with defined responsibilities and expectations in the office, adding some bucks to the office, and then a bonus payment at the end of the year if quality metrics are hit. And those quality metrics are increased number of visits to the office, certain CMS and other outcome measures that are NQF approved, and patient satisfaction. And we find dollar savings, as I commented. So this requires additional staff. And I think the point of this slide is that value creation in this system is an explicit expectation and set of processes. It's not a hope. And it's not, you know, guys, here's another 20 grand a year, please do better things. It is very specific. So health policy implications, people need health insurance, please include regional plans. Geisinger is a regional plan which has been innovative. I think formation of of accountable care organizations, in my term, integrated systems, should be facilitated. Others have spoken about those. The definition of a medical home currently employed by NQF needs to be enhanced. Right now it sort of says, well, you got an EHR and you have a registry and you try to do good, and it needs to be a little more explicit. Health information technology is needed, but again, how it is implemented and the need to keep educating people and changing it over time must not be lost. Those are ongoing costs that are not usually included in the capital costs of buying the system and the equipment. We do need comparative effectiveness research, which has been funded in part. And I think very importantly, outside of a dozen or two organizations in the U.S., Geisinger, Mayo, Intermountain Health, Kaiser, and some others, many people do not yet understand how to do this work. And so training, particularly of the current and next generation of nurses, physicians, hospital administrators, and others, is really needed, and we shouldn't lose sight of that. Thank you.
Thank you, Bruce. And I failed at my first task as timekeeper and set it so the speakers got an extra minute for every minute that they spoke, so I'm going to delegate that to someone else. And to welcome Dr. Nancy Nielsen, who is president of the American Medical Association. She's a practicing internist in Buffalo. New York. She's a nationally known expert on issues of patient safety and quality issues. She also takes the lead in the AMA's Voice for the Uninsured campaign. In addition to her medical degree, she holds a degree in microbiology, and she's agreed today to give us a sense of how practitioners in healthcare look at some of the proposed changes in payment methods. Dr. Nielsen.
Hi, everybody. The most important thing you heard is that I don't live in Washington, and I'm here to try to help you understand what the physician perception is of some of the very well-done work that you have seen presented so far. The closest I get to the White House is at the White House summits and the signing of SCHIP, although I will tell you that the White House called my office on Wednesday and the secretary lost the call. Yes, it was a stunning moment in my office, actually, just so you know. You may know, I hope you know, that the American Medical Association agrees with the president that healthcare reform is a priority. I hope you also have seen what we have done on the Voice for the Uninsured campaign. This is not new for us, but we became very visible about it because we got tired of everybody talking about the uninsured and having the annual week for the uninsured, and the numbers got worse. So we really have taken a pretty high-profile approach to the uninsured, and we have been pleased to have met with a number of the administration officials. Just last week, Zeke Emanuel spoke at our national advocacy conference here, as did a representative from Geisinger presenting some detail on the medical home that you just heard Bruce speak about. We had here in the city last week leaders from all over the country in every specialty in every state, and it was important for them to understand what's happening in your town and what may be about to happen, and to try to make sure that those who are in leadership positions are not too far out in front of their troops. Now, that's really important because the last thing anybody needs is to have the troops rebel when something gets done. And so we have some leadership challenges, but I think you can understand that. Physicians want change. They're really pretty unhappy people right now. A worldwide study of physicians shows that American physicians are the most unhappy in the world. They are drowning in demands, and there are some bad people, but the vast majority work heroically every day. And it's, I think, really important as we talk about people who game the system that we remember that that's not what's happening across the country. It's happening in isolated places, and it needs to be dealt with. We do know there needs to be change. We do know that there needs to be better coordination of care. You've heard from Bob and from Bruce and Stu about this. There's no question about that. It isn't rewarded right now. And, of course, you don't pay us for everything we do. You don't have to pay us for everything we do. On the other hand, when you deliberately don't pay us for some things, it does send a pretty powerful message. I mean, you know, you understand what I'm saying. We're all humans. It's very important to remember that the vast majority of practices in this country cannot immediately form into a group like Geisinger or the Mayo or Scott and White in Texas. They can't do it. So you are looking at an awful lot of physicians in this country who are practicing in what is termed onesies and twosies, groups under four. It is a real challenge. And to try to say to them that, well, you should align yourself with a hospital and let the money go to the hospital, and then you guys figure out how to divvy it up with the hospital, they will tell you, we've been there, done that, and it didn't work. So you just need to know that there is not an enormous amount of trust that would work. However, physician practices absolutely want to improve. They want to adopt HIT, and the new infusion of money to try to make that happen is going to be very powerful as we try hard to improve quality for the patients that we care for. The third bullet down there is an important one, and that is we would hope, as this town proceeds towards some sort of payment reform, that you recognize that clinicians work in different circumstances. And so until we have proved the value of some of these models, piloted them, and surfaced unintended consequences, hopefully there can be some flexibility in how practices can adapt. Do they want to? They absolutely do. And if we all treat physicians not like people who are trying to get away with something and meet their income expectations, but people who are really working hard for their patients and appeal to what is absolutely motivating them, which is their professionalism, and not disincent them to do professional things, which is part of the problem that you've heard about. I will mention that physicians are very concerned about their ability to band together, even to do quality initiatives, because of some antitrust issues. We have asked that that be looked at, and people are hopefully listening. The specialty societies have stepped up, and they will step up more. They have determined appropriateness criteria. As you hear about the comparative effectiveness, which, by the way, we are firmly and unequivocally behind the generation of that evidence. It's really important to use the specialty societies because physicians trust their specialty societies. They do not trust the government. You may have noticed that. They do not trust Congress. You may have noticed that. And you need to know that they also clearly do not trust health plans, insurance plans. They don't. But they do trust their specialty societies, and they have done a very good job. I would point to American College of Cardiology, the Society for Thoracic Surgery, American College of Surgeons, among many others, and you know that. It's very important that data on performance be fed back to the clinicians so that they can improve, because this is really not just about a report card. This is about improving care at the point of care. That's what we want. Help us do that as we go forward with our reform efforts. Well, there are a number of things. You've heard them mentioned. I'm not going to go into them. You've heard about the medical home accountable care organizations. We need to pilot those. We need to see what works. And it may be that some will work in some areas and some in certain rural versus suburban versus urban, et cetera. That needs to be surfaced. And we've talked about the lack of trust between physicians and hospitals when it comes to bundling. Can we reestablish trust? Of course. But it really is important to make sure that we try this and see how it works first. The HIT is going to be important. Comparative effectiveness is critical. And we think that there may be a problem if it's a one-size-fits-all immediate shift in payment. There are absolutely problems with the pay with the fee-for-service system, and everybody knows that. It's also important, as you've heard others speak, to talk about giving incentives for coordination and quality. And I think you can simply read through this. There's no question every American should have health insurance. There's just no debate about that. Let's, as a country, figure out how to get there in a way that is fiscally responsible. And let's just do it. Let's just do it soon. When it comes to how you're going to pay physicians, they want to be paid for the things they went to school to learn how to do. I will tell you, yesterday was match day throughout the country. You may know that. Every graduating medical student found out yesterday at noon where they're going for the next 3 to 7 years of their life. My medical school has 140 graduates. Exactly four of them matched into family medicine. Exactly four. That is a real problem. What are we going to do when everyone has health insurance and there are not enough primary care physicians to take care of them? It is a very serious problem, and you can't do this overnight. Beyond college, it takes a minimum of 7 years to grow a fully trained physician in anything, any primary care specialty or anything else. A minimum of 7 years beyond college, and in some cases 11 to 13 years. Be careful about enhancing primary care at the expense of the other specialties. That's the quickest way to divide the House of Medicine. You've seen it happen before. It's a strategy that's been used before. It's not a smart strategy. It makes everybody unhappy and everybody hate everybody. And by the way, they will hate Washington a lot. This deals with the supply. There are every workforce study that's ever been done has been wrong. So we just know that we need more clinicians. We need more nurse practitioners. We need more PAs. We need more physicians. And we need to figure out how to get them here. And then this is my final slide. Let's indeed invest in prevention, in care coordination, in making sure that everyone has health insurance, that HIT does what it's supposed to do, which is not just to have a computer. We all have computers. But we don't have what we need, the interoperable standards that will allow us to embed the quality measures and track the quality measures, the registries that will allow me to push a button and bring up all my diabetics and see what their hemoglobin A1Cs are. That's what we need. We need to test the new payment models that you've heard eloquently described here. Liability reform is a topic for another day, but I got to tell you, docs are very convinced there's an awful lot of defensive medicine going on, and it does not add to clinical care. And then finally, there's no doubt that we need to get better value for our healthcare dollars. We can do better as a country. We as a profession intend to do better. We ask for your help. Thanks very much.
Thank you. Thanks to our panel. So with that, we'll open it up to questions. If you want to send questions up, we'll take them. If you want to just have a microphone brought to you, we will do that as well. And meanwhile, don't forget your evaluation forms that are in your folders. So why don't I start with some of the cards that have come up. The first one had to do with the effectiveness of pay-for-performance programs, citing the Premier demo, the recent survey by the LeapFrog Group. They seem to suggest that there's evidence of improved quality, but is there evidence of savings? So what do we know about pay-for-performance? Stu?
Well, there are, in preliminary results that the Premier folks have put out related to demonstration, it does seem that they have been able to cut length of stay, which doesn't save Medicare money, but also reduce readmissions, as well as improving quality of care. But I think, so I think there's promise there, and certainly you'd have to convince me that it's a bad thing to pay for what you want as opposed to paying for what you don't, more of what you don't want, which is what our current system does without pay for performance. I think, though, that there's a limit to how, you know, there have obviously been some studies that have found that have had more mixed evaluations of pay-for-performance initiatives, specific ones. But I think we need to take into account what Bob, point Bob's raised, that, you know, we're talking about always at the, you know, improvements at the margin for a system that's really kind of rotten to the core. So, you know, we need to take that into account. It's kind of like, you know, trying to road test the Model T Ford before the roads were paved. You'd come back and you'd say, boy, this really, you know, doesn't have much of a future because you can't drive it when it rains. After it dries, the roads are rutty and it's a really bumpy ride. It doesn't really take us anywhere. You know, so you really have to envision these kinds of policies in the context of a better performing health system. And that's why all of these changes are kind of important to address together.
I might just add to that. I think if you look, most of the programs are paying for structural things or what I think you could characterize as minor improvements. So having a computer, measuring a hemoglobin A1C, which is a measure of control of diabetes, as opposed to controlling the hemoglobin A1C. I think the P4P demo that we're part of has clearly shown progress in advancing the quality variables. It some groups have shown an ability to save money. I would say that that experiment I view is still positive but ongoing. The third year results are due in the next few months. project's been extended into a fifth year. I know our medical home stuff didn't kick in at our place really until the end of the third year and really in the fourth year. So I think it'll be a bit before we know.
If I could also make just very quickly, it's important also to distinguish, to identify the fact that measurement has a cost to it. You have to get it right. You have to often do special data collections. And so on this issue of rehospitalizations, which I think most of us agree we have to address, there's just avoidable rehospitalizations that we could deal with. One approach which has been promoted is to measure every hospital's readmission rate and then provide public reporting and pay for performance or maybe penalties for the negative outliers. I'm suggesting it may be premature to put it in the whole system yet. You just embed a new incentive in the payment system, which is all hospitals don't get get a reduced payment for a readmission. You don't have to do as much in the way of measurement, have pay for performance. You're embedding a new incentive. Clearly, you need a higher threshold for going in that direction. I mean, a higher threshold of knowing what you're doing so that you don't have untoward side effects. But it is a different approach. You can try to get the same result of reduced rehospitalizations, one through pay for performance and public reporting, the other by changing basic incentives in the system.
Let me just comment quickly. The AMA has had guidelines on evaluating pay for performance programs for probably 4 or 5 years. What we want to be careful about, and in general, I think in many places they have worked. I don't know if they have saved money, because I think that was originally the question. What we are very concerned about is that we be looking at quality first, and that we not in any way disincentivize the taking care of difficult patients. You really have to be careful about that. We want to be held accountable for what we can control. But if I give a prescription to a patient and that patient, and forget Medicare for the moment, let's assume the patient has a commercial health plan, and the copay for that prescription is so great that the patient can't fill it, then it's time we are all accountable together for what is not working in the system.
Well, we've got a lot of interesting questions, so start here at the microphone. Introduce yourself, please.
Josh Seidman from the Center for Information Therapy. This question is primarily for Dr. Hamery. You had talked about HIT as an enabler and it being a necessary but not sufficient tool in the patient-centered medical home. And thinking about one of the biggest provider incentives that the government has ever developed, which is coming out of the American Recovery and Reinvestment Act for provider incentives for HIT adoption, I'm curious if you have specific suggestions for how to define meaningful use of an EHR, and particularly given your emphasis on the use of a patient portal, it's an important part of Geisinger's success. If you have specific suggestions about those kinds of provisions, that would be important to ensure effective, efficient care management and better health for patients.
Thank you for the question. I think it's very on point, and there are certainly people at our place, Jim Walker, who's our medical informatician, more competent than I to answer it. But I think there are a number of key things. One, as was mentioned by some of the other panelists, it has to connect to something else. So, you know, a standalone system in a doctor's office that only has information from that doctor's office, doesn't link to lab work from the hospital or wherever they get lab work done, doesn't link to the pharmacy, is not sufficient. It would be optimal if there were a way to receive feedback from the pharmacy about other medicines the patient is getting, because most patients see multiple doctors. They may not all be on the same system. And whether or not the patient picks the medicine up, which gets to Dr. Nielsen's point, we know that 30% or so of prescriptions are never filled, and by 6 months it's 80% or some huge number. So some metrics around that. I think there are certain features of it. Does it alert about drug-drug interactions? Does it have a function that allows a registry? Again, to Dr. Nielsen's point, who are my diabetic patients? Are they coming in to see me? But again, I think that the first item is, does it link, you know, is it part of a regional health information exchange or have ability to link to some other database with the appropriate protections? And then last and not least, you know, at least ours, Kaiser's, the ones that many other people use, do have an ability for the patient to come in, request appointments, request med refills, look at their problem list, print their drug list, print their list of immunizations, and those sorts of things that simplify life both for the patient, family, and the office.
Let's go on the back. First one back there. Want to introduce yourself?
Thank you, Karen. John Green with the National Association of Health Underwriters. Dr. Barrison, I was hoping you might be able to clarify one of the slides. It says medical home payment could be fee for service for medical services and PPPM for medical home activities. And can you just clarify what you mean by that dichotomy between medical services and activities?
Yeah, the traditional medical services, which for a primary care physician would be office visits for the most part, but could include minor procedures, that would still be paid through the Medicare fee schedule, presumably, perhaps reduced, that's a question. And then the activities of medical home, which, you know, there have been attempts, and CQA has the prevailing one, to define what those set of activities are, but much more robust communication with patients through phone calls and secure email, more communication with other physicians, providers, community services, teaching patients self-management skills, so a whole series of things like that, which I argue do not lend themselves very well to fee-for-service. I mean, you can't reimburse for every phone call for lots of reasons. So a package of those services would be then compensated through a monthly payment. We would need to assure that those services are being provided in some way, and there are different ideas about how to do that. But that would be the notion. Pay fee for service for the established office visits and a monthly fee for activities that we think our good medical home chronic care management activities.
Thank you. Thank you. I'm going to take one of the cards to Dr. Nielsen, and the question's about bias toward proceduralists in the RUC committee.
Well, the bias toward procedures and proceduralists long predated the formation of the RUC. I mean, if you think back, I mean, some of you are not old enough to remember, but some of you I think are.
In you may not days, remember the Model T.
In the old days when there were only the Blues, you know, kind of the indemnity health plans, maybe you don't know this, but if a patient came, when I started my practice 30 years ago, when a patient who had a Blue Cross Blue Shield came in to see me, if the patient came in for a physical, I didn't get paid. They had to have a diagnosis. There had to be a problem. There was not, I mean, the one thing that the HMO movement did is it taught us to put our priorities in the right place. Let's value prevention. So this business of always paying better for procedures is way long before the RUC ever got formed. There has been criticism of the RUC. They have identified misvalued services. They have also identified some misvalued services, and CMS has not adopted those recommendations. So absolutely there is a bias still in this country toward proceduralists. Here's my only point. You could blow up the RUC. You could put in something else. But let me tell you what you're going to have to deal with. You're going to have to deal with the workforce issue in this country. Because what you don't want is every ophthalmologist to hang it up and retire. Who's going to operate on your cataract? You can't do it. You've got to look at this and make some gradual changes. Everyone is agreed. Primary care is undervalued. Something serious must be done there.
We'll take the first person here. Introduce yourself.
Thank you, Karen. My name is Meg Voris with the Advisory Board. First, I'd just like to commend all the panelists for excellent presentations. Many of you talked at a high level about accountability in the Commission on High Performance Health System that some of you helped to create. There's also a section on accountability saying shared accountability for resource use was favored among many healthcare opinion leaders. My question in relation to bundled payment is twofold. First of all, how do you recommend holding healthcare providers accountable for the use of resources in patient care? And secondly, I'd like to hear any of your opinions on gain sharing between hospitals and providers. Thank you.
Stu, do you want to take that?
I'll start. I'm sure there are other opinions on this too. But first, I want to make clear that when we talk about financial incentives, there's a tendency to talk about them as if they're something to be imposed on providers to get them to do what we want them to do. And I think that's the wrong way to think about financial incentives. I think the better way to think about financial incentives is that they are a way to change the system of rewarding for the things we don't want and punishing for the things that we do want, and to really free up providers to do the things that we think they really want to do, which is to treat their patients best. If we have a system where providers that's not the motivating force behind provider behavior, we have bigger problems than we can take care of with the kinds of reforms we're talking about here. But I think we don't. I think providers do want to take good care of their patients. So the idea is to figure out, as Nancy said, to figure out different ways that those things could be applied, depending on what the organization of care is like in the area, what the particular organizations you're dealing with are structured like, and to get together with providers and figure out how we can support the kind of behavior that we'd like to see and that they'd like to see, and then put the payment system in place that encourages that kind of behavior.
Bob, did you want to?
Yeah, just very briefly. Again, my preference would be for accountability at a large integrated group level, because that group is in a better position to assess the performance of its physicians and other clinicians than a distant third-party payer. So I'm all for trying to figure out how to promote more Geisinger-like organizations, recognizing the diversity of the system. But 20 years ago, when I was doing primary care capitation, my HMOs were assessing how I was doing on cost management, and it wasn't done very well because there was no risk adjustment going there for measuring the acuity of my patients. There were a number of sort of technical problems. But conceptually, I think we are in a much better place now, actually. We don't necessarily have to assess the downstream spending for each individual physician. We might want to assess the number of avoidable emergency room visits and hospitalizations associated with a primary care practice. There are some areas that we actually can, I think, do assessment on the cost side. We can certainly, we're in a better position now than we were then to measure some basic parameters on quality. And I think we also need to much more routinely assess patient experience with care. We now have good questions. Commonwealth has used those questions in doing their cross-national comparisons. The question to a citizen, after hours, do you have a place, I don't know if this is exactly right, do you have a place that they know you and you can, if you have an urgent problem where you can call and have somebody responsive who knows you, is a great question as to assessing whether a medical home is really responsive to their patients. So I actually think we are in a much better position on cost, quality, and patient experience to begin to assess accountability, even down to the individual practice level, although, again, I'd state my preferences to aggregate it at much higher levels.
Just, I guess, one other comment, just to second what Dr. Gooderman said. You know, I've never met, and I know you didn't imply this, either a physician, a nurse, or any other healthcare professional who went to work saying, I'm going to hurt somebody. Everybody starts with good intentions. I think what the incentives need to do is to make that simpler to attain. And you've heard a number of things around that. The accountability pieces come around metrics and around performance to metrics and around, if possible, a little additional reward for hitting those metrics. They're positive reinforcements, not negatives. We've got lots of negative reinforcements now. We've got malpractice issues and, you know, various state boards of professionalism and so forth. So I think it's around restructuring the payments and which helps restructure the organizations to make it easier to accomplish what both physicians and their patients and other care providers want to get done.
I'm going to try another one of the cards, which commends the AMA's Voice for the Uninsured campaign, but ask if the AMA also has guidelines that encourage physicians to accept Medicaid patients.
Sure. That, I always like the yes, but questions. We commend you, but here's the zinger, right? The first of all, people who are uninsured don't have Medicaid by definition, right? And I live in New York. In New York, the Medicaid program covers a number of services. Many patients wish that they could have Medicaid. There is an answer that you need to know and you should know because it was in the president's budget. That's the formal answer. And then there's a heartfelt answer. And let me, if I can, I'm going to try to quickly give you both. In the president's budget, there is a line in the budget that says, if public programs pay significantly less than commercial insurance, what happens is the costs are shifted to the commercial insurance, and it raises the healthcare costs for people who have insurance. That's the formal answer. We have to know that. We have got to have everybody with health insurance. Now, let me give you the heartfelt answer. Some of you know a little about me, but I want to tell you my story. I went to graduate school in this city. I was at Catholic U. I had two babies during 3 years of grad school, like you do if you go to Catholic U. You understand? And what you don't know is that the student health insurance that I had specifically excluded pregnancy. And it specifically excluded family coverage. So guess what? I had two babies at Providence Hospital, and I went to public health clinics, and I am so grateful for that safety net. When I, years later, went to medical school, I remember taking my kids in to see an ENT doctor and seeing a sign on his wall saying, "We do not accept Medicaid." I was outraged. I was outraged because I had been poor, I had no insurance, and I was really outraged. So I started my internal medicine practice and I took all comers. And I was in a large multi-specialty group. And I did that because I didn't want to worry about the finances. Well, let me tell you something. There was somebody in that group worrying about those finances. Because when I got so many Medicaid patients that I wasn't able to make the payroll of my office staff, I had to stop taking Medicaid patients. It was one of the saddest days in my life. But now here's what I did. Didn't do it right away because I didn't know how. But 2 years later, I left that multi-specialty group and started a new group in association with the hospital, and here's what I did. I said, you know what? I want to be empowered to take care of any patient that wants to see me if I have time to see them. So you pay me productivity, but not on the money you collect, on the services that I rendered. And that was the last 6 years of my practice. It was the most empowering that I have ever experienced. And so I share that with every doctor can't do that. I was in a town where I could do that. But it's not easy. So the real heartfelt answer is no margin, no mission. And it is tragic. But the president has it right in the budget.
Okay, we're going to go to the very back if you'd introduce yourself.
Well, unless I'm missing something, I did not pay for a registration and got a free lunch. So I want to thank Commonwealth for bringing us together for this purpose. I have a question and then maybe a comment. Fee-for-service rewards for volume. And we all go into medical school. I'm from Yale. From medical school with good intention, but humans are human. So therefore, when you're rewarding for volume, you can figure out what happens. On the other side, if you pay for capitation or salary to become socialized medicine, then you have less access, human being human. Is it possible to have a hybrid in which you pay 60% fee-for-service and 40% tie in with the electronic medical health record, which is an enabler, to reward them for pay for performance, for quality, for outcome, and for being a good steward of the healthcare dollar? Is that possible?
So schizophrenia?
The answer is yes. Some commercial plans are already doing that. And I think that's what Bob described.
And the other point I'd make is, again, some rewarding volume. There are some doctor groups who may, or specialty groups, make the correct statement that they don't self-refer. They respond to referrals from others. So a pathologist isn't generating their own specimens for the most part, and it may be appropriate for a good pathologist in a community to be paid fee-for-service for doing that. The radiologists make this case, and I think they're largely correct that they don't generate volume because they're receiving referrals from others. For primary care docs, where we want to be promoting a whole different kind of activity, not related to acute care management, but chronic care surveillance and proactive work, what you're suggesting makes perfect sense of having a mixture of fee-for-service, and per member per month. I've, with Steve Schoenbaum and Alan Gorel, I've written that maybe some practices could actually get a single payment without fee-for-service. That's an alternative. I think to me the bottom line here is that you can't anymore have a one-size-fits-all payment system in Medicare or amongst private payers.
And Dr. Hamrick?
I would comment, we've been doing this for 12 years, and it requires a leadership group that is sensitive to patient need and can adjust this so that it's not, you know, it's not like setting up a train schedule that just then runs forever. Somebody needs to worry about whether the tracks are cleared and all that. But yes, a hybrid model, in large part based on what Dr. Nielsen described, which is roughly benching salary to work RVU so that it is payer neutral and you're not penalizing your pediatricians and obstetricians and family practice folks for seeing Medicaid or no-pay patients. And we have a 20% incentive, of which half is quality metrics, so that we can also embed and encourage certain behavior that is already incented by group practice culture. But yes, those are very possible. Whether you can in fact do that with a piece of legislation for the country as a whole, I think is a different matter, and I would suggest would be left up to these, you know, PHOs or physician groups or accountable organizations or whatever mechanism you want to call them, to figure out on a local basis, because you do have to keep the specialists and the primary care guys happy. I mean, we have, you know, neurosurgeons and orthopedic surgeons and other people that are very highly paid in our group, along with others who are paid well but more modestly.
Yeah, I agree with my comment, if I may. I agree with Dr. Nielsen, president of AMA, that there are about 700,000 doctors in the country. About 100,000 of them are in so-called institutions like the Kaiser Clinic. Those are things the hybrid will work very well. But unfortunately, there are about 600,000 who are the onesies and twosies, and that is where the difficulty comes. And I think the other comment from my colleague, we're both physicians, Dr. Nielsen, she mentioned about electronic medical records. The way I understand it, having studied this for the last decade, is that the blockade is done by the industry of electronic medical records. They don't want interoperability so that you can buy their product. So it's a little financial. The technology has come now where it is very easy to have interoperability and bypass all their blockade. And for what Dr. Nielsen mentioned, pull up all her patients who are diabetic and who has not had an A1C or A1C higher than 6 or whatever, it can be done. So look out for that new technology. In a summary, is no different than you at Yahoo, I have Hotmail, you have AOL, and yet we can communicate. The technology is here and is practically free. So I think we, with that enabler, we would be able to do the hybrid. Thank you.
And I think, thank you very much. And for people who've worked on this IT issue for a long time, I think we are beginning to make a breakthrough with the American Recovery and Reinvestment Act committing significant resources. The announcement today of Dr. David Blumenthal, designated to head the Office of the National Coordinator for Information Technology. Gary, would you introduce yourself?
Gary Christofferson, former of CMS, VA, and DOD. One point, then one question. Point is, if we're really thinking about health, we ought to be thinking about sort of refining our terms. One, it isn't patient-centered, it's really person-centered. Second is it's really not a medical home, it's really a health home. We ought to be thinking about terms we want to use to get to the point we want to get to. I want to go back to the issue of sort of what you all have argued pretty consistently as a group, is that we want to move more toward integrated approaches. I'm not going to say integrated systems per se, the formalized one, but more toward that direction. We seem to be caught between sort of, or at least heavily caught between, it's either one model or it's the other, and we can't sort of find in between. The question is, with the new ARRA kinds of money coming through, EHRs, PHRs, all those kinds of things, exchange, with different models, whether we can go to more what I would call virtual health systems. We actually created one back in 1977 in inner city Milwaukee to deal with inner city health between public and private sectors. So the question, I think, to you all as a group is, how do we use in-between models, models that don't require necessarily formal structures, but don't leave us locked into the strictly onesie-twosie model in terms of their, and sort of more virtual systems organized to take care of a group of people?
So, Bob, you want to take that on? How do we get to more integration from where we are today?
Yeah, let me do two things. One is on your point about terminology. You know, the healthcare home instead of the medical home. I've seen a recent article that Murray Ross is the lead author on, who many people here know, in which focus groups of seniors say, in fact, there was one person said, medical home, nursing home, funeral home. The whole term probably needs to be reconsidered. And in fact, this is a very interesting article. It has a whole bunch of other terms that we're all using, like comparative effectiveness, that are really misunderstood by the public. But I take your general point. I think there's a model that hasn't gotten much attention. It still is alive and well because I've just been there in Southern California. In California, the IPA, which has onesies and twosies, but there is an organization, an accountable organization that the places I interviewed, they were buying electronic health records for a number of their practices. They were doing quality management. They were doing utilization management. I spoke to one head of a large medical group who said he had thought his wraparound IPA network was a transition model to get people used to this, and they move into the medical group. His current data is showing that they do just about as well on cost and quality, but have higher patient satisfaction scores. And he's thinking maybe this isn't even a transition model. Maybe it's a real model. So I actually think we can move towards population-based payment with a range where there are hospitals and physicians who are tightly aligned because the docs are essentially employed by the hospital. They are in a position to do this kind of thing. Where we have the multi-specialty group practice, where we have IPAs, I think we could be moving more quickly in this direction without having to go necessarily through these intermediary steps of bundled payment.
Dr. Nielsen?
Let me comment on that because that's exactly right. The IPA model is the way to do it, but there are some barriers to clinical integration, and we have asked the administration to look at perhaps loosening those barriers. It's a real high bar. It's very tough for practices to do this. In my hometown of Buffalo, there is an IPA. There are only two IPAs that are really up and running, and one of them are essentially people in solo or small group practices, and they have joined together, and I only know about this because my son's their chief data analyst, so I hear about it. I mean, what they have done is astonishing, and they are able to gain share, but there are some real impediments to the vast majority of people doing that. We would hope that those of you who are involved in looking at these issues will look at perhaps removing some of the barriers to clinical integration, because I got to tell you, we are where we are with practices right now. You are not going to make everybody a Geisinger or a Mayo tomorrow, but you could quickly move, as Bob has described.
Remind everybody to fill out your evaluation forms. Take another one from the card. That is, how do we address the geographic variation in costs? Stu?
Well, there are a set of things we can do that directly and indirectly affect costs. And on the direct side, one of the aspects of the payment reform proposals in the Commission's report, The Path to a High-Performance U.S. Health System, is to give updates based on the geographic variation in costs in areas. So high-cost areas might get lower updates than low-cost areas. But that changes payment, and it certainly provides an incentive for providers in those areas to reconsider how they provide care. But I think the key thing is the kind of support you give for the changes in provider practice. And that includes comparative effectiveness. The comparative effectiveness, the main value of that to this system is that it allows people to make smarter decisions about how to provide health care and what health care to provide. And since it's been shown that a lot of what drives the variation in health care costs in different areas is the mix of services that are provided, and mostly the services about which there's not a lot of evidence as to the effectiveness of, providing more evidence would allow people to make better choices as to how they configure care. And other policies like health information technology, improvements in coverage, they all provide a mechanism for disseminating the kind of information that makes providers, patients, and payers better decision makers.
Thanks. I'm going to take the question there at the microphone. Yes. Introduce yourself.
Hi. My name is Nathan. I work for an organization called the National Health Council. My question heads back into the comments Dr. Nielsen made regarding the overall percentage of Medicaid patients she could take in her practice. I was wondering if these speakers were familiar with the reports that just came out from, first of all, MedPAC, the annual March report, and second of all, the Milliman report, and the discrepancy in the conclusions there. If you're not familiar with the conclusions, basically it's been the central focus of the debate on the last three hearings I've been to. Milliman report saying that the low payments from government programs, specifically Medicaid and Medicare, lead to cost displacement and a subsequent increase in premiums to private insurers. And on the other side, the MedPAC report saying that government payments are just fine to provide efficient and proper care that can actually lead to better health outcomes than private insurers, which there was some conclusion there that saying it led to inefficient use of resources.
If I could take the prerogative of changing the question, since I don't think we're going to resolve the cost-shifting debate right here, and ask the panel if they think we ought to be moving toward at least narrower differentials in payment rates across providers.
Among specialties?
No, I'm really talking about there's the Medicaid level of payment, there's Medicare level of payment, there's a commercial level of payment. Should our policy be designed to try to narrow that differential across payers?
Well, I think that would be helpful. For many years I got paid New York Medicaid rates for an hour-long physical were $11 for a new patient, $11. For any repeat visit, it was $7. I mean, for 20 years. Now, how can you do that? How can you really do that? So there has to be some, justification for making sure you can keep the doors open. Remember, physicians give uncompensated care. Nobody's talked about that today, but they do. Throughout this country, they do. Let me shift it to a hospital. If you don't think cost shifting goes on, try going to an emergency room with no health insurance and look at what your bill is. And don't tell me there's not cost shifting. Of course there is.
Bob?
I just would absolutely endorse the concept of narrowing the differences. Economists argue about, is it cost shifting, is it just straightforward price discrimination? The reality is that in some nationally, private plans pay 20 to 30% more than Medicare rates. In Medicaid, in some states, is 50 to 60% of Medicare. Those kinds of differentials cause lots of what I was talking about earlier, behavior distortion. When you have dish hospitals that are trying to survive in, say, Southern California, they're making it only because there are dish payments. They have large uncompensated care burdens. They're getting 50 cents on the dollar from Medi-Cal. And you've got other hospitals that have a much better payer mix and are getting much multiples above Medicare. That's not a good healthcare system, and I think we need to be moving towards narrowing those differences.
Okay, when you're talking about narrowing those gaps, specifically what I'm my perception of what you're saying is that we need to be heading having the government programs up their payment levels towards private insurers, and that's am I wrong there?
Let me make a couple of comments on the points you've raised. One is, remember that the biggest discrepancy in payment rates across payers is for the payment rates that providers get for patients who are uninsured. So one big step toward equalizing payment rates would be to cover people who are uninsured, because then there's payment attached to them. And if you look at the effect of the uncompensated care pool in Massachusetts before they had their universal coverage initiative, you found providers, strangely, talking about competing for uninsured patients because there was payment attached to them now. In fact, unfortunately, the payment that many providers got for uninsured patients was much higher than the payment they got for Medicaid, for MassHealth patients and Medicaid patients. So there's certainly a discrepancy there. Secondly, one of the reasons that many public payers pay less than private payers is that there are limited tools available in the current fee-for-service system to control total expenditure. That's really the bottom line. And you take something like the SGR mechanism, which had to come up when we're talking about payment reform. The SGR mechanism is simply a system that tries to control total spending by cranking price per unit down because they can't. There's no way to control the number of units. If you had a better way to control the number of units by having broad accountability for healthcare, you wouldn't have the kind of pressure to crank down on prices per unit that you have, and in fact, prices would be on much bigger units that are more meaningful in terms of healthcare. Thirdly, when people talk about cost shifting, they look at payments relative to costs, but they forget that there's a denominator in that figure, and that is costs. You can say that Medicare pays less than hospital costs in the aggregate, but you have to look at whether the costs that are incurred are appropriate as well. And you have to ask the question whether a public program should be chasing high cost increases if those cost increases are higher than they should be. So you have to kind of look at that aspect too.
So Bruce, the less work.
Yeah, I think just to put the point on this, this last point I think is very important and also relative to a previous questioner about health as opposed to medical. And I think we should not forget that a number of emergency room visits and hospitalizations among uninsured and underinsured people result because they do not have access to primary care and to appropriate preventive care. And so I think there is another piece of this, which I think in Dr. Guterman's paper and others was explained. So it's a multifaceted issue.
And with that, again, let me encourage you to fill out your evaluation forms and turn those into staff and join me in thanking our panel.